You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Hello and good evening. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting from the beautiful coast of Northern California on Sunday, August 9, 2015. Today I'd like to start a series of podcasts on growth hormone deficiency and replacement. This particular podcast will focus on growth hormone deficiency, its definition, its diagnosis, and sort of set the stage for subsequent podcasts that will talk about the clinical syndrome of growth hormone deficiency, what happens when you treat the disorder, how you go about getting started on treatment, etc. So, how about a definition? Well, I consider growth hormone deficiency to be a deficiency of growth hormone that leads to diminished IGF-1 production. But it's not just that. It's not just deficient or low normal IGF-1 and growth hormone levels. It's a clinical syndrome associated with those hormone abnormalities. So we don't just want to treat blood tests. We want to treat the whole patient. Growth hormone is produced by the somatotroph cells of the anterior pituitary gland. It's stimulated by growth hormone releasing hormone from the hypothalamus and inhibited by somatostatin from the hypothalamus, with somatostatin being the main regulator of growth hormone secretion. Most growth hormone is produced at night while we're sleeping. And in fact, if you checked growth hormone levels in adults, 50% of the time they would be undetectable during the daytime. And that's one of the reasons we'll get to later that growth hormone is not necessarily a good diagnostic test for growth hormone deficiency, or at least an isolated growth hormone level is not a good diagnostic test, that is. Growth hormone stimulates the production of IGF-1 and a number of IGF-1 binding proteins by the liver, and the binding proteins carry IGF-1, but IGF-1 circulates free as well. It ultimately binds to IGF-1 receptors, and growth hormone and IGF-1 work as a dual hormone system, with both having direct effects on different body tissues. We think of most of those effects as being anabolic in nature or buildup in nature, so that, for example, growth hormone causes the uptake of amino acids, which then get incorporated as building blocks of protein, so we build muscles. We increase bone density in response to growth hormone. Cellular proliferation is increased in response to GH. Growth hormone is also a lipolytic drug, so it burns fat, and it also can cause salt and water retention at the level of the kidney. That's just a brief introduction to some of the main things that growth hormone does, but it's a combination of growth hormone and IGF working together, for example, that carries out most of these functions, especially including those that are most apparent during childhood, which is long bone growth resulting in stature. I like to think, however, of growth hormone as important in all stages of life. It's probably misnamed because it's a very important hormone of intermediary metabolism. In other words, it's a metabolic hormone, not just a hormone that promotes growth. So these actions of growth hormone, if you will, ultimately, when they're deficient, lead to the symptoms and signs of growth hormone deficiency, and I'll review that in a subsequent podcast. But for now, I want to talk about some of the things that cause growth hormone deficiency, and basically, any disease of the pituitary gland can be associated with growth hormone deficiency. Some of those include empty cella syndrome, Sheehan syndrome, craniopharyngiomas, pituitary adenomas, for example. So if there is a diagnosis that can cause hypopituitarism, you can get growth hormone deficiency. Interestingly, if a patient has had surgery of their pituitary or has a pituitary lesion and all other hormones are normal, there's about a 40% likelihood that they have isolated growth hormone deficiency. The more hormone deficiencies you have of your anterior pituitary, the more likely you are to have growth hormone deficiency, such that if you're panhypopituitary with diabetes insipidus, there's a 99% chance that you will also have growth hormone deficiency if your physician were to test you for that
particular deficiency by performing a stimulation test, for example.
There are a number of patients out there who have what we call idiopathic growth hormone deficiency, and that's where we just simply don't have the explanation for what's going on. Many of these have short stature, and we're in the lower third percentile, which in this day and age, if your child can qualify you for testing impossible treatment with growth hormone, but many adults were never tested, and they just happen to be shorter adults and have growth hormone deficiency. I had a very interesting patient a number of years ago who presented with osteoporosis at a very early age, in her early 20s. It was interesting because she had asked her mother to get a bone density, and the mother said, "I will if you will," but the daughter, who was much younger, had osteoporosis. So she came to me for evaluation, and we couldn't find any obvious cause, and I noticed that she was about 5 feet 1 or 2 inches tall, and asked her about her parents, and both were much taller, and she should have been about 5 feet 7 inches tall herself. So I presumed that she might be one of these patients with idiopathic mild growth hormone deficiency who'd had it all her life, and it led to her not achieving her final adult height, and led to the osteoporosis, and tested her, and sure enough, she had growth hormone deficiency, and with growth hormone replacement had improvement in her bone mineral density. So there are a number of people out there with idiopathic growth hormone deficiency. Some of them have empty cella syndrome. Others have normal appearing pituitary glands. I think that obesity itself is associated with a functional growth hormone deficiency, and in some cases would treat an obese patient who had an abnormal stimulation test result, because we're not really sure which came first, the growth hormone deficiency or the obesity. That's the classic chicken and egg debate that we all get into. When it comes to diagnosis of growth hormone deficiency, as I mentioned before, a random growth hormone level is not diagnostic, because levels are usually peaking and spiking while we're asleep, and low 50% of the time in adults during the daytime. The IGF-1 level you might think would be a better test, and it certainly is, but the accuracy is only about 75%. And that's because the normal range is a wide variation, and we don't know what's normal for you. So you might have a low normal IGF-1 and have thus a normal result, but if your level is supposed to be mid-range normal or high normal, you can actually be growth hormone deficient with a normal IGF-1 level. And studies have showed, when IGF-1's been compared to dynamic testing, that it's about a 75% accuracy with IGF-1. So in my practice, if a patient has an IGF-1 level that's in the lower fourth of the normal range, we consider that as potential growth hormone deficiency, and we'll conduct further evaluation to see if that patient might actually be deficient. And the sort of best way to do that is to do any one of a number of growth hormone stimulation tests. The insulin-induced hypoglycemia test is the gold standard, but that's very cumbersome. It's risky to make the patient hypoglycemic, especially if the patient also has adrenal insufficiency. So we tend not to do that test. There have been a number of tests over the years that have been compared against that gold standard. It used to be that growth hormone, releasing hormone, and arginine together were probably as good as the insulin-induced hypoglycemia test, but growth hormone-releasing hormone is not readily available for diagnostic testing any longer, so we usually use another surrogate test, and the one that's used most common is the glucagon stimulation test. But there are other tests as well, clonidine stimulation test, the L-DOPA stimulation, for example. I would say that the latter two tests are probably more likely to be falsely abnormal in adult patients, but are better tests for children. So in most adult patients, I think that now we would use glucagon or arginine in place of insulin-induced hypoglycemia, and not really bother with the clonidine or L-DOPA tests. When it comes to cutoffs for stimulation, there's been a lot of controversy in the literature about the appropriate cutoffs. Some physicians believe that a level of 3.0, anything above that is normal, and a level less than that is growth hormone deficient, and that in obese patients you should use a cutoff of around 2 or 2.5. I can't remember the actual number. However, in my practice we use a cutoff of 5.0, and that's because I think that if you use a cutoff as strict as 3, you're going to miss people who truly have growth hormone deficiency. And I say that because I've done hundreds of stimulation tests and looked at hundreds or maybe thousands of IGF-1 levels, and I get the general feeling, or the gestalt, that in patients who have pituitary disease, having an IGF-1 that's low or low normal, you and a growth hormone under 5, that's a secure diagnosis of growth hormone deficiency. If you test enough normal people who have otherwise normal pituitary function, normal glands, you see that these stimulation tests result in growth hormone levels of 10 and 20. Or more. So even using a cutoff of 5, we may be missing some people with mild growth hormone deficiency. However, I'm not sure that there's a clinical benefit to treatment in those patients who have extremely mild deficiency relative to those with moderate or severe deficiencies. So in my practice, we'll use a cutoff of 5 to determine who is treated. Other practices might use a different number, and I think that that can be a negotiable figure with patients and insurance companies, because I think that insurance companies are still looking at some of the literature that says a cutoff of 5 is the most appropriate. In regards to obese patients having a lower cutoff value, I'd mentioned before that we don't know what comes first, the obesity or the growth hormone deficiency, but I do believe that some patients with obesity have functional growth hormone deficiency and probably benefit from a trial or temporary usage of growth hormone to burn some fat, build some muscle, change the body composition so that then you restore growth hormone secretion to normal. All right, that's it for this podcast. Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News. Have a lovely evening. Thank you for listening.